Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 362, I chat with Joe Kane, Jeff Tully, and Ron Williams about the recent QLED and HDR10 summit. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 13th, 2017. Episode 362, QLED and HDR10 Summit. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week, I have three guest geeks joining me, all returning guest geeks. First up is Joe Kane. Hey, Joe, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Then Jeff Tully. Nice to see you, Jeff.
Good to see you, too.
Yeah. And finally, Ron Williams. Hey, Ron, welcome back.
Scott.
Those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv, can join the chat room there or at irc.twit.tv, and you can post questions as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So the reason I gathered this august group together is that we were all attendees at the Samsung QLED and HDR10 Summit, which was a solid 2 days of super geek out mode. And we all thought, you know what? We should share this with the Home Theater Geeks audience. So here we are to do exactly that. As the name implies, not so indirectly, the main topics of discussion were QLED and HDR10. Now, we're going to start with QLED, which is a term that Samsung uses to describe any TV that uses quantum dots. And I've had a number of people on the show in the past who come from companies that make quantum dots. And it's a pretty loose term, though, this QLED. They mean it to sort of be like OLED. But I think it's less exact than OLED. It really is more like LED TV. You guys, I'm sure, remember when, and I think it was Samsung that first did this, started calling its LCD TVs with LED backlights LED TVs. Joe, you must remember that some years ago, right?
Absolutely. One of the things that I strenuously objected to when it was happening, it was rather confusing.
Very confusing. I agree with you completely, because to me, an LED TV is more like, you know, the Jumbotron at a sporting stadium or the Fremont Street Experience. If you're in Vegas and you go to Fremont Street, you see this giant thing overhead, and it's actually LEDs producing the light directly, the image, I mean, directly. Whereas in LED TVs, the LEDs are the backlight, and it's still an LCD TV. Ron, you must have felt similar when that term came about, right?
Oh, I objected big time to that. I just kept telling everybody it's still an LCD TV, different backlight. So
yeah,
why market
exactly
what the backlight is when it's basically an LCD, and the LCD TV still has all of the artifacts and the problems that we object to, but they're just going with a different backlight to give the contrast and color a little different. That would be the difference. But the fact is, you're still dealing with an LCD TV, and it's got its problems.
And so it does. And QLED is even more confusing because it could mean one of several different things. Jeff, don't you think that that's more of a problem maybe than it's worth?
Well, yes. But right now we've got so much alphabet soup going on with, you know, even HDR and HFR and UHD and the ultra of UHD. I think all four of us could argue in favor of Ultra being a little bit less used as a resolution and more as a functionality, but we don't end up writing the marketing literature.
Indeed. Still in all, here we are. We've got QLED, and it refers to any TV that uses quantum dots in any way. The good news is that it's Samsung, I believe, acquired the use of that term when it bought QD Vision, one of the companies that makes quantum dots, and they had that term, and so Samsung got that term in the buyout. But they're making it free to use. Anybody can use it if they want. So, you know, if that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't really know. What I want to talk about today, what I want to start with anyway, are quantum dots, because we spend a lot of time at the summit hearing about quantum dots and all the different ways that they could be used in a QLED TV. So let's start with what they are. Let's make a review a little bit here about exactly what they are. Let's see, which of you would like to sort of start with just sort of a basic description of what is a quantum dot?
Well, if I may, from the slide from our presentation, they say quantum dots and quantum rods are nanoscale particles. They're in two categories, the photoluminance and the electroluminance. So the photoluminance absorb blue light and readmit it in green or red, and the electrode emits red, green, or blue light, applying different currents, kind of like OLEDs do.
Right, exactly. Now we have I have a picture of what a quantum dot looks like, and they could be rods as well, but mostly I think we're talking about spheres. So let's take a look at QD structure, and we see here that it has a core, it has a shell, and it has what are called surface ligands. And the material that's used here is a semiconductor material. So it's kind of like a semiconductor, like chips or transistors or whatever. And the typical materials are cadmium selenide and indium phosphate. And man, oh man, my eyes started glazing over when they were getting in deep into the chemistry of this. You know, there was like, oh man, you need a degree just to understand what's going on here. Jeff, did you catch any of that, or was that like for you as well?
Oh no, I try to keep my eyes open during the presentations and kept copies of the slide decks for later.
Right, exactly.
If I may interject, I think the important part of the chemistry was the discussion of cadmium.
Yes.
That it's a known difficult commodity to dispose of, to deal with, and interestingly enough, that there are cadmium batteries as well. So the quantum dot industry is seriously concerned about cadmium, yet. Probably because there is a replacement, but maybe not an efficient replacement. But interestingly enough, because the battery industry, cadmium is so important to it, in that there are, or maybe with lithium too, but there aren't really good replacements for it. So in the battery industry, they're just letting this go. In the QLED industry, they're really concerned about the chemistry. And in a way, it doesn't make a lot of sense that we allow something to happen in one technology and not another, or, you know, we just dismiss it in the battery industry and yet we're really concerned about it in the QLED industry. So I at least had the impression that part of the discussion of the chemistry was about having to dispose of these entities, at some point when it was time to get rid of them.
Right, exactly. Now there's only tiny bits of cadmium in a given TV, right? Because these quantum dots are so tiny, they're in the order of 2 to 5 to 10 nanometers in diameter. And yeah, there are millions and billions of them in there. But that's really not very much cadmium, especially compared to a battery. And yet in Europe, they've obtained they have gotten dispensation is the word I was looking for, with cadmium for quantum dots. Yet you're right, Joe, the industry is really concerned about cadmium, and they're working very hard on developing cadmium-free quantum dots. Go ahead, Ron.
It's the Rojas exemption that the Europe got, and right. There are cadmium-free quantums available, but now they're going into the hybrid, the mix of the cadmium-based and cadmium-free. Mm-hmm. And the Rojas does have a specification for that, that they don't have to have the dispensation for, that they do meet if they do the hybrid.
That's where the dispensation is. Okay.
Right.
I gotcha. All right. But the chemistry, that was the main thing that people were talking about at the summit was, you know, we got to be able to make cadmium free. The problem is cadmium based quantum dots have a very narrow spectrum. Basically, what we haven't said yet is a quantum dot takes in a blue photon, say some blue light from an LED, and then re-emits a red or a green photon. Ron, I guess you did say that. And we have a picture, actually, of QD spectrum that shows us sort of the difference between what happens with quantum dots and what happens with a typical backlight. You can see in this picture the sort of light blue line is the spectrum that you see more or less in an LED backlit TV, whereas with quantum dots, the blue spike is the blue LED. That doesn't change. But the green and the red spikes are very narrow, typically 25 to 30 nanometers with cadmium. It's more like 40 to 50 nanometers with indium phosphate, so cadmium-free. And this FWHM, by the way, is full width half maximum, is how the bandwidth or the width of this spectral emission is specified. So we get very narrow red, green, and blue peaks instead of this broad thing here. And Joe, I know you've got some things to say about why that may not necessarily be a good idea.
Well, certainly it comes to the way we see light. And it turns out that all of us see light differently if we look at it on a nanometer by nanometer spectrum. When light is covered with a very broad spectrum, everybody will agree on what they're seeing. When a color of light is covered by a narrow, very narrow spectrum, we are aggravating the difference in the way each of us sees light. So from experience from my own display devices, when I have a broad spectrum of red, green, and blue, everybody agrees on what the light, you know, what the color looks like, and it makes color correction easy, as an example. But when you get very narrow red, green, and blue as a source of light, there's often a discussion or disagreement on what people are seeing. So it actually makes color correction much more difficult. Among the things that were presented is that the consumers don't care. And that the only people that are going to see this are colorists. I'm a little disappointed at that position, but there are certainly a number of papers that were written by people at RIT, as an example, that basically claim that narrow bandwidths of red, green, and blue just won't work. And I am in that camp. I would rather see a slightly broader spectrum of red, green, and blue.
So maybe in that case, the indium phosphide or cadmium-free quantum dots, which have a broader spectrum of green and red, might actually be better. They're not quite as efficient at converting blue light into red or green, but because they have a broader spectrum, you might see more consistency and agreement from one person to another about what color we're looking at.
Right.
Jeff, did you certainly? Yeah, you know, go ahead.
I was just going to, sorry, I expected Joe, I expected you to respond to that, and I apologize for not leading you into that. So what, go ahead and finish your thought.
With the delay, forgive me, but with the delay of the audio, sometimes if the conversation isn't directed towards one person, by the time one person has jumped in, something else is already going on elsewhere. But I stand by the position I've been taking is from experience, at least within the post-production community, and looking at my own projector that's used in quite a number of post-production houses that has a very broad spectrum for red, green, and blue. I've been told by a large number of colorists that it's a much easier to display to work with than the old CRTs, which had two narrow spikes for red, and the broad coverage that I have for red in my projector has made life really easy for colorists. They've all told me that it's an infinitely better display than they ever had with the CRT. And we know it's the broad spectrum of the red that is helping them see a much more consistent picture than they're used to seeing. So it's based on that I question the narrow spectrums.
Mm-hmm. Now, Scott, sorry, go ahead, Ron.
That's part of my objection to this big move to the LED lighting that we have in the home, because it is so spiky. If you put that in your closet and you're picking what you're going to wear, by the time you get outside, you're going to look at it and go, well, these reds don't match, and this doesn't match, and that doesn't match. Because, supporting what Joe said, the spikier it is the less broad spectrum of light that your eye takes in, and you really don't see things properly. And I've objected to that, but, you know, the world's moving on to these LED lights because of economics and business, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes down to the true light, it's so spiky that you're not getting a true representation. And when you do see what is white light, your brain is filling in the gaps of those three spikes. You know, and this brain's filling that in.
As opposed to sunlight, which is very broad spectrum. So as you say, you look at something under artificial illumination with these spiky LED light bulbs, and then you walk outside, you know, you're going to see a different color of the same thing.
Yeah, I'm concerned with that, and the e-readers are the same. That white light on an e-reader is, you know, what's going to happen in how many years to the people's vision when your eyes just kind of give out after seeing all that hard spikes. But the quantum dots, yes, it's more color. You know, the spikes are bigger. But the spectrum isn't wider, and I have to agree with what Joe's saying. You know, when you're doing critical color evaluation, it's better to have the broad spectrum. You know, if you look at a power curve in comparison, which I've done many times in projectors, measure the digital projectors with the spikes, and then you put up a film projector with an open gate and just a white light on the screen, and you measure
coming from a xenon lamp.
Right. And it's a just nice, big, broad, white, full power spectrum, as opposed to seeing your, you know, three little spikes.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, your brain's filling that in, so you're fooling yourself.
Yeah, yeah. And one person is fooling themselves slightly differently than another person, as Joe pointed out.
To Joe's point, that's true.
Yeah, exactly. Jeff, let's talk a bit about the different ways that one can use quantum dots in a display. And the graphic I have here is QD form factors. There are several different ways that Ron mentioned a little earlier that we can do this. Do you remember seeing this graphic? You must have.
Yes, vaguely.
Vaguely. So the way we do it now is with a film, right? Basically a film impregnated with quantum dots.
Yeah, I think that's the predominant way. And they were talking about using it, you know, as filters and as you know, as active light generators as well. So it's
right.
It was interesting that they, as you've already pointed out, you know, were saying that all of these are QLEDs. The functions and the behaviors are all radically different.
Exactly. As I said, the film is the one that we're using today primarily, which is blue LEDs hit a film, a plastic film, which is embedded with red and green quantum dots. The blue light causes them to glow red and green. Not all of the blue light is absorbed, and so that combines with the red and green, and you get white. And then you go through a color filter like you always have, and that's how it works. Edge optics is similar. It's a tube of quantum dots along the edge. But the next one, pardon me, the next one that we talked quite a bit about at the show was on chip, which is actually embedding quantum dots into the LED itself. And then you got white light coming out of the LED. Up till now, we've done that with phosphors. And Joe, you know something about phosphors.
Yes, just something.
What do you think about the idea of using quantum dots in an LED instead of phosphors to create white light?
Well, using – all right.
You get the same problem here.
I'm struggling to fit the analysis of or even where phosphors fit into this. But I'm sorry, you trapped me in wanting to connect this to phosphors, and
phosphors. We've used phosphors for a long time.
Yeah, I'm struggling to make a comparison here.
I can help you out.
Go ahead.
You know, the biggest thing here is we're dealing with a solid state device that is emitting light, where a phosphor has to be ignited for it to glow. And that's the biggest difference. You know,
but the phosphors in an LED, say you have a white LED, which consists of a blue LED with phosphors in it.
Right.
And the phosphors are hit by blue light and they glow, right? Similar to quantum dots.
The phosphors are more mechanical and they are not as reliable because each one's going to ignite differently. So there is a big delta difference between the way phosphors are going to ignite and emit, or I shouldn't say emit, they reflect, versus a quantum dot that is ignited and it just glows.
Plus the fact that phosphors are going to decay over a period of time. In theory, could end up changing color. In theory, I think often.
No, times. Factually, they will. Factually, they will.
Yeah, part of my yes, so that and that's actually what I should have been reaching for in the comparison of using phosphors as opposed to quantum dots, that quantum dots should produce a much more stable color of light, and in theory over that the amount of light should be closer to the same over a much longer period of time. So in that sense, it should work better than phosphors. When we were doing this, or when you had the diagram up and you talked about full backlight versus edge lit, one of the things that has surprised me is that some companies going to quantum dots have left full LED backlit behind and gone to edge lit QLED, which sort of surprised me in the sense, I suppose it's less expensive, but in what we're trying to accomplish and trying to get bit depth out of displays, I kind of think that full backlight is still going to be necessary if we want a high-end display. And in a way, I was almost disappointed that the full backlight seems to be going away in the particular examples that we were shown in this presentation, this 2-day long presentation. Mm-hmm. And I, granted, there are weak points of full backlight, like not enough individual areas. And I've recently seen some full backlight sets where the area of each backlight was so large that when you had rolling credits, it was like optical glare going on. There were very serious optical glare going on because as the credits would roll up the screen, you would see white light behind all the credits. And and so this white light was going up along with them. So certainly full backlight has a long way to go. You've got to be able to make the controllable area much, much smaller than is currently going on. But it, at least for the moment, I'm disappointed in the fact that as we make this move to supposedly a better technology, we're doing it with edge lighting instead of full backlight. And that was something that I didn't think was adequately covered in the seminar.
Well, that's a good point. And I think what I want to make sure everybody understands what you're talking about in terms of a full backlight is a full array of LEDs behind the screen. So instead of having LEDs just along the edge, one edge or another, you have a full array across the entire backlight of the screen. And full array, FA, local dimming, LD, so the whole thing is called FALD, F-A-L-D. The local dimming means that certain zones of LEDs can brighten or darken independently and give you greater contrast and greater, it's a better picture.
Better support local areas of the picture.
And yes, exactly. And if those zones are big, then you get this haloing that you've been talking about.
Yes. But of course, if those zones are really small, and of course, we've already talked about being able to modulate those zones, if they're small and we're able to modulate those zones, we can actually add a bit depth capability to the LCD display. We can augment the bit depth capability of the panel itself with the backlight.
Yep. now, one possibility that was talked about quite a bit at the summit was replacing the color filters in an LCD TV with quantum dots, with little pieces, little sections filled with quantum dots. And I have a graphic here, QDCF, or color filter 1 and 2. So actually, first of all, go first to photo enhanced, QD photo enhanced. So this is the way we have it now. Basically, you've got an LCD, you've got a blue LED passing through a film of quantum dots labeled QDEF here, passes through the LC layer, liquid crystal layer, and finally through color filters, a red, a green, and a blue. This is pretty inefficient because most of the light gets filtered out of each of them. Now, if we go to QDCF number 1, we can see this is much more efficient. The color is coming from what used to be the color filter. And the blue light from the LED is just passing straight through without being modified really at all. So we get much higher efficiency, much greater luminance, brightness out of this. And we think we should see the first examples of this at CES next year and probably products by the end of the year or so on. And the other quick diagram I wanted to show people was QDCF number 2, which basically adds a color filter on top of the quantum dot color filter. And the reason for that is the ambient light from the room hitting the front of the TV could actually activate the quantum dots and cause them to glow, and that would look really weird. So there is a one way to take care of that is to actually put color filters on top. But then the color filters have to be tuned very carefully to the same narrow band that the quantum dots are issuing and let all that light come through. So that was just one thing I wanted to make sure everybody understood. And finally, the last piece of this quantum dot puzzle is QD App 3, which is called electroluminescent. And Ron, you mentioned this earlier, and I want to get back to it just a little bit here, because in this case, you have, you know, it's like an OLED, and you apply an electric current, and little pieces of quantum dots glow green, red, or blue, and it works just like an OLED TV. And that's when I think the term QLED becomes relevant and significant.
Right, right, exactly.
Scott, if you would go back to the diagram that that you just had, where you were showing the three pieces of light coming out, and you were showing that the blue light is coming out directly, and you were showing that the red and green light were coming out not directly, but at all sorts of angles. I believe
it was
Gary Merson. Yes,
that's QDCF number one.
Yeah, I believe it was Gary Merson that got up and said, "Well, isn't this going to affect off-axis viewing?"
Good point.
And I think his point needs to be remade here, in that with LCD sets, we already have off-axis viewing issues, and this approach could be aggravating those off-axis viewing angles.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Another point that was made during the presentation was, the quantum dots actually emit light in all directions. And so some of it actually goes back down into that sandwich structure. And so they're talking about reflectors and light redirectors to make sure that all the light ends up going out instead of some of it coming back in. So I thought that was pretty good. Barfel is asking, how are the QDs addressed? If the dots are used to both provide color and modulate the light coming from the screen, they have to be addressed somehow. That's right. They have to be modulated. They're putting out the right color, but how do you make them dimmer or lighter? That's the job of the LCD layer, the LC layer that was there, the actual LCD subpixels. Those are what brighten or dim and allow more light to get through from the backlight. And that is how it's done. So we need to move on here. I wanted to touch upon, we mentioned putting quantum dots in LEDs, and there was actually an interesting presentation about micro LED displays, where you have tiny, tiny, tiny little LEDs that are, in fact, directly emitting and producing the picture. Without an LCD layer to modulate the light level, as Barfel asked about. And examples of that include the Sony Cletus, which we saw at CES last year, and the Samsung Cinema Screen, which, Joe, you and I talked about. You saw it at CinemaCon. And yes, we heard about it as well at this event. Each pixel is a tiny group of RGB micro LEDs, which are only microns in size. And we have a photo micrograph of called micro LEDs. Those things are only 10 microns across, or the pitch is 10 microns. So they're center to center, 10 microns across. One of the problems there is, phosphor particles are larger than that, so they have to use quantum dots, because there's no other way to make the LEDs glow in the right color. There's also a photomicrograph of a micro LED RGB array that I wanted to show you. This is just, again, these are super tiny, and I think the future, one of the futures possibly, of displays, electroluminescent quantum dots is one, and RGB micro LED arrays is another. So, and these are still in the research and development stage. Jeff, have you ever seen? You saw the Cletus, I'm sure, at CES, right?
Yeah, I did see that. I have not yet seen the Samsung.
I haven't either. I think Ron, have you seen the Samsung?
Yes, I have.
I know Joe really liked it. What was your impression?
It's amazing. It's remarkable, actually. I think that is definitely way the future of cinema exhibition is mm-hmm. going into that screen, because it's immersive. But anyone who knows exhibition knows that that's going to create problems, because now we do have backlash light from the projector hits the screen and then throws a backlash light back towards the projector. With this, you're just and they cautioned us not to say this, but it's, Joe, you have to agree, it's the only way you can really describe it. It is like a great big TV, because it's emissive light.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's glowing right in your face, and it's pretty bright. So anything in that theater, that light's going to bounce off of, including the people. Mm. So it's going to be interesting. When we were doing the SMPTE DC-28 cinema standards, we had a theater that we did testing with down on Hollywood Boulevard, and we would try to balance a projector, and the image versus the technical setup was very different, and we were having a hard time with it until one of our colleagues, Richard Stumpf, great man, figured out that the red velvet seats in the theater, the red backlash was bouncing back up on the screen. Of course, it's not a factor when your theater's filled with people, but we had to go cover all of the seats.
So
this technology is going back into that arena where the light, Joe, the light coming from the Samsung screen is pretty overwhelming. I don't think the backlash would be that great.
And the backlash is going to be even less, because you can literally shine a light on that screen and it will absorb the majority of light. If you go back and look at the diagram, if you look at the pictures of the LEDs, you're going to find that the majority of them are surrounded by black. And so what's happening is the area that is not emitting light is actually absorbing light. So,
right.
And the demonstration that I saw with Samsung, they literally put a light on the display, and it effectively didn't change the quality of the picture. That panel is basically a light absorber when it comes to anything hitting it externally. Mm-hmm. So I looked at this and said, gee, this is a really good thing.
Try shining a flashlight on a projector screen.
especially when they're talking about 500 nits as at least a beginning of a light output. They're talking about hours to 250 nits. In other words, it is going to decay in light output, but they're going to start out at 500 nits. By the way,
before you go on, let me just, by way of comparison, typical cinema projector reaches about 48 nits. Dolby Vision,
so 10 times.
Yeah, Dolby Vision reaches 100 nits. This is 5 times brighter than that.
Right.
Yes.
A conventional screen is 2,500:1 contrast ratio. In the Samsung is infinity. That's their statistic. So it's like,
because it goes to full black, goes to real. Exactly.
Well, and part of the reason they're able to claim that is that even when there's ambient light, the black out of the display is still black.
Right.
So that even in the face of exit lights, the row lights and reflections off the seat, you're still going to maintain a higher contrast ratio than you are off a projection screen. Mm-hmm.
The other advantage with this is going into high dynamic range. The HDR with this technology is incredible. So, HDR is not something that it does. It's just a byproduct of what the technology is. So these elements with everything we just described are very, very good. The color rendition is better, the contrast ratio, and the HDR is just there. So it's killing three birds with one stone.
Mm-hmm. Mike Heiss in the chat room is reminding us, and something I wanted to make sure we just touched upon, is that with the Cletus or the Samsung Cinema screen or any of these micro LED displays, they are not acoustically transparent. So you can't put speakers behind them as they are in virtually all commercial cinemas today. You have to put the speakers above or below. And Samsung talked a little bit about this, saying that they have a technology that sort of uses DSP to make it seem like the sound is coming from the screen itself. But that's kind of an important consideration, don't you think?
Well, considering that they bought Harman, and Harman is a premier audio company, to me, it's not that big of a deal, because in home theater, we've been doing Phantom Center for how long? Almost forever. You know, I don't have a center speaker. I use a Phantom Center.
Ah, there you go.
And so what they're doing is they're putting speakers above and below the screen and doing the Phantom to the center of the screen.
Mm.
You know, it's not magic, and it works.
Mm-hmm. You know, Certainly putting a speaker above and below would allow you to make a phantom image right in the middle of the screen, and that would work very well.
And then you throw Atmos on there, and the rest of the theater is all audio anyway. So I don't think it's a point to note, but I don't think it's going to be any challenge. I don't think anybody's ever going to notice it.
Mm-hmm. Digmax in the chat room is asking, wouldn't being that bright cause eye fatigue?
They're not going to run it that hot.
Well, not necessarily. Joe, go ahead.
Even if they do, one of the questions I asked during the seminar is, with that kind of contrast ratio and that kind of light output, don't you think that ambient light behind the screen is going to be absolutely necessary?
Mm.
We have long been advocating, even at 30-foot Lamberts or 100 nits, that it is absolutely necessary to have light behind the set, so that you have a bias light to keep the fatigue factor down. I backlight my home theater screen here, because when I have a new lamp in, I'm getting 23 to 26 foot Lamberts, and that is way too bright for me to watch without some sort of ambient light around the screen. And I've done tests here for members of the DCI and Digital Cinema Initiatives. And mm-hmm. among the things that they've noticed, which actually pleased me, they said, you know, when the bias light is on, the contrast off the screen looks a lot better. Meaning that by closing your irises down just a little bit, suddenly the blacks actually look better than they did, in a totally dark room. And I was surprised when they just commented, oh, we like the picture a lot better with the bias light on, that we're actually seeing more contrast from the picture. There's that. But I also talked about the 100 nits of the Dolby the high dynamic range cinema. Mm-hmm. And several people that have attended my meetings here have said, well, you know, they got through the 100 nit movie just fine and didn't notice any fatigue. So what I did in my place is I started them off watching a movie with the light on, and then I shut it off and I just waited. And about 15 minutes later, it was, can you please turn that light back on? Because they didn't understand the fatigue until there was a differential between no fatigue and fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't understand the fatigue that was set in as part of the 100 nit Dolby level. And I was running maybe 75 nits, not 100 nits. And they didn't understand the fatigue until they felt the difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then they got it. And then it's like, oh, yeah. So in my world, I don't really care what light output that they run, as long as there's a sufficient ambient to work with it. They can run 1,000 nits. I don't really care.
And, as long as the bias light allows you.
Yeah. That's right. As long as the bias light's there, I don't really care.
Scott, the other big benefit to this technology is two things. One, you have perfect white field uniformity on the screen.
Yep.
And there's no geometric distortion.
Right. You're because not if dealing you're, with you're projecting from, yeah, if you, you project from a single point, basically, the projector lens, and it fans out, the light fans out,
right.
There's going to be geometric distortion and there's going to be uniformity issues, which are people work very hard to solve, but they go away with these micro LED displays. So
the picture is sharper, clearer, the color rendition is better, and with the white field uniformity, you're seeing a better overall picture with the color imagery, obviously, with the white field uniformity. But with a screen, you know, the projector may not be in perfect alignment or the screen moves. In the theater, they, you know, do masking, but some theaters actually move the screen. So there's an issue there of the screen introducing the geometric distortion. So this technology eliminates all of those things.
Yeah, yeah. I was heartened to hear that I believe the first Samsung cinema screen in a commercial cinema is being installed soon, if not already, in Korea. There will also be a demonstration screen here in L.A. It's not going to be open to the public as far as I know. But I'm looking forward to going and seeing that because I haven't seen it myself. So I'm looking forward to Samsung inviting me to come see that thing because it's really pretty great. Listen, before we run out of time, I want to get to HDR10 and HDR10 Plus, which was the other part of this summit. And quite an important part, I think. Certainly, one of the big points that was being discussed by Samsung, particularly, who in sort of developed this, was what's called HDR10 Plus. Now, HDR10, which is the high dynamic range format used on Ultra HD Blu-ray, almost exclusively, a couple of examples, a couple of counterexamples now, but primarily that's what it is, and also a lot of streaming and so on. This is going to get pretty geeky here, but that we're all geeks on this bus. They use what's called metadata because they have to be able to tell the display what was the brightest thing in this movie and what was the sort of max average of this movie. But they only have one piece of information for each of those for the entire movie or TV show or whatever. What Samsung is, and that causes some problems. And in fact, I wanted to show what the problems were. Those being HDR10 tone mapping. Let's start with that. And I'm moving pretty fast here. And we can see that if the peak of the display is 500 nits, but the maximum brightness of the mastering was 1,000, then the TV's got to roll it off. If the maximum brightness of the mastering was 2,000 nits, it's got to roll it off faster, more. And so the picture generally ends up being dimmer. If we go to HDR10 STM1, we can see what happens with static tone mapping, where you can design this tone mapping curve, which tells the TV what to do with stuff that's brighter than it can do. You can set it up so that you can preserve the dark stuff and the mid-tone stuff, but the bright stuff gets oversaturated. Or you can do it the other way with HDR STM2, and you can preserve the bright parts and the mid-tones, but then the dim scenes look too dim. Their answer is what's called dynamic metadata and dynamic tone mapping, which is HDR10 DTM. And that lets you use different tone mapping curves for dark scenes, mid-tones, and bright scenes. And in other words, preserves everything, no matter what your TV is capable of doing versus what the mastering display was capable of doing. And that's one of the real challenges of HDR, of high dynamic range, is, Joe, you talked about this in your presentation. You know, in SDR, when we were in the past with CRTs and standard dynamic range, everything worked the same. Mastering monitors, presumably, mastering monitors, consumer displays, the content all was supposed to match. Now, with HDR, you've got so many different capabilities, TVs that can reach a few hundred nits, TVs that can reach 1,000 nits, TVs that can reach almost 2,000 nits, as in the Samsung Q series, versus what do they do on the mastering display? Those are different too, 1,000 to 4,000 nits. So how do you deal with the fact that now the capabilities are different from one TV to the next, from one mastering monitor to the next, from one piece of content to the next? Joe, you dealt with this pretty well in your particular address there.
Well, I dealt with it in one way. A comment that I want to make just based on what you're saying is we just do away with PQ. I recognize that it's supposed to be much more efficient at a it's much more efficient in the way it handles the bit depth that's available to the signal, but the description of what you just gave us was we have a fixed curve for producing a program, and we're trying to play it back on a variable system. So we're actually trying to figure out how to make fixed variable. Mm. And this actually has nothing to do with the presentation I did, but I wanted just to take forward what you're discussing directly and say one of the things that bothers me about PQ is that we can't do it. That OLED can't do it. PQ is supposed to be all the way out to 10,000 nits. Well, there's nothing that does 10,000 nits, but there's some stuff that's mastered at 4,000 nits. And why is it being mastered at 4,000 nits when there aren't displays out there that go above 2,000 nits? I'm going to say 2,000 because that's probably the upper limit of consumers. So why are we even mastering on an absolute curve when there is absolutely nothing out there that can reproduce it?
By the way, just to make sure that everybody understands, PQ that you're referring to stands for perceptual quantizer. It's basically a curve developed by Dolby, now standardized by SMPTE, that tells the TV if you get a pixel that's supposed to be a certain brightness, play it at that brightness. So the curve is slightly different than what we've used up till now, called gamma. And it's as Joe says, absolute. That means every point along the curve represents a specific brightness in nits, or candelas per meter squared, to use the more correct term. Whereas gamma is what's called relative, so it goes from 0 to 1. So whatever the TV can do, it follows it. Whereas PQ is absolute, and this is what we use mostly for HDR these days. And Joe, you're advocating something pretty radical, which is you think we shouldn't be using it.
Well, I basically it doesn't work as it's put together. And among the things that would tie into the presentation that I did is that we need to have more variability. Now, I'm normally not an advocate of variability. I want everything fixed. I want to know exactly what I'm doing. But that's never going to happen in this world. We've opened up Pandora's box with HDR, with UHD, with wider color gamut, with higher frame rates. Standardization is off the table for what we're doing. And so I actually firmly believe that we have to build a system that will accommodate all of this variability. And that was the presentation that I had done during the seminar. I basically wanted to throw back to a point in time when DCI was variable. In other words, projectors were already going into theaters before standards had been set. So projectors had to be built so that down the road, when we actually did figure out what we were doing, whatever projector was already there, it could be tuned to whatever came about in the new system. And that technology has been employed in consumer products. The projector I have on the market, when the first one, 720p version, came out in 2003, it had the technology to measure itself. Well, you measured it and told the projector what it was, and then you told it what you wanted it to do, and it would calculate the difference. And what you want it to do can come in the form of metadata. So if I suddenly want to do my program at D60, another color of gray, as opposed to D65, I just tell the projector to go to D60. Or if I want it to do Adobe RGB instead of P3, I just tell it set itself up for Adobe RGB. Now, the capability was developed and really put together well for the DCI. And so the technology already exists to do this. And
by the way, that's Digital Cinema Initiative. That's for digital cinema. And Joe, you were talking about putting projectors into commercial cinemas, digital projectors, before the DCI had finalized its specs. And so those projectors had to adapt.
That's correct. And
well, there was just a precious few of those from Technicolor that went in at that time. So, and I agree with what Joe's saying, but that was just a short period of time.
But the technology to calibrate the projectors all still exists. That method of measuring what the projector can do on its own and then calculating the difference to where it needs to be still exists in every DLP projector today.
Mm-hmm. The other curve in there we should talk about, Scott, is the hyperlog gamma, HLG, which is the alternative to PQ. And most of all of the acquisition cameras, you choose whether you want to do HLG or PQ. And the HLG curve is a lot more flexible of what Joe is saying, where the PQ is hard fixed. Well, the HLG is flexible. And you can program it to be whatever you want it to be, which is the opposite of what PQ is, and I think what Joe is advocating. So there is an avenue for that. And most of the broadcasters doing the HDR are opting for HLG rather than PQ.
I think HLG was designed more for broadcasting than for packaged content, like pre-done, post-produced podcast. Television shows, movies on disc, that sort of thing.
Well, no, HLG is capable of anything.
Sure, of course. But its primary application up till now, I think, according to the BBC anyway, who co-developed it with NHK, has been for broadcast, right?
Right, yeah. A video. We'll just use the term video, although digital acquisition for feature films is theoretically video. It is, in fact, for anything is 3840 by 2160. That's the avenue that they went with BBC and NHK. Mm-hmm. Of course, until BBC just decided that they didn't like the curve and now they want to change it.
Oh, really? When did that happen?
Yeah. About a month ago.
Oh, man.
Yeah, NHK's not really happy about that.
We're still in the Wild West here in HDR.
Yeah. Well, there isn't that many things out there right now that are hard-coded to do that. I mean, all of the cameras, whether they're cinema cameras or broadcast cameras, it's a choice, and you tweak it, and life is good. And I think, Jeff, are the set manufacturers, are they putting both decoders in the TVs? I'm not sure.
Some of them. I know LG, is from the standpoint of the HDR, is trying to accommodate almost every HDR spec that's out there. And they showed that at CES. HDR 10 Plus is not on their roadmap, but all the other flavors.
Yeah.
Right.
Jeff, I wanted to get you in here you spent some time looking at Florian Friedrich's proposed test methodology. He had some interesting ideas, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, we saw a number of different, you know, interesting demonstrations there of, you know, looking at the impact of, you know, comparative value, I guess, of the HDR 10 Plus and the HDR 10. You know, you and I both also saw the comparison that ColorFront was putting on there of, mm-hmm. you know, split screen showing the HDR 10 and 10 Plus, kind of going back to what you were saying earlier, you know, what's the difference, the scene adjustment and correction.
Right.
You know, and Florian was showing some interesting things, although one of the things I noticed in looking at his demo, it was possible to highlight the distinction between the two elements he was showing. He was showing an OLED set on the bottom, I think,
on the bottom,
demo,
yeah,
and a quantum dot set on the top, and showing that, you know, there was a capability of showing the picture more stably in the quantum dot. You know, he put a light meter in front of a particular test pattern and showed that the screen brightness was fluctuating a fair amount as motion content was playing on the OLED, and it fluctuated much less on the upper display. But it was interesting that in order to really get the impact of that in terms of the quality of the upper and lower picture, you really needed to be staying, you know, standing right in front of the two TV sets so that their center line was the same. If you moved far enough to the right or left, you saw a bigger difference between the top and the bottom as a result of the relatively narrow view of the LED set as compared mm-hmm. to the OLED. Mm-hmm. So it's the variability that Florian was showing and demonstrating, it was fascinating to see it. But it washed out a little bit if you got off
when you axis. Went off axis, yeah. His yeah. point, I think, was very well taken, which was getting back again to this variability of capability between different sets. If we look at the graphic called FFL versus window size, luminance versus window size, we will see two TVs that he measured. And as the window size, as the size of the white window increases, one of the displays decreases its brightness tremendously, and that had to be an OLED, versus that would be display B, whereas display A maintains much more of its luminance capability. So right there is an example of extreme variability between two different TVs. And so what he proposes in order to evaluate that is placing a small test pattern in the center of actual content. And so the picture that we showed a moment ago called the FF demo shows that. It shows this, and he put this together, a little patch just overlaid onto motion content. And you can see in the center of this, the center major part of this little patch, in this case, is 1,000 nits. And then he's got a little step pattern above going, I think, 500, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 1,000. And you can see when you're looking at an image with low overall light, say a night scene, he's got something it's very dark generally, then the difference, the ambient light is very similar between the two, or not the ambient light, I mean the luminance. And then when you play a bright scene like this one, the difference is very great. More so on the OLED below than on the QLED, Q9 above. And so this is an indicator that Florian proposed of HDR stability. You know, how stable does it stay depending upon what it's showing. And so I thought that was pretty interesting. And I just wanted to make sure that we touched upon that.
One of the things that I find interesting in that demo, not that it was aimed at doing that, but if you took the two displays, and notice that the demo was a little bit less aggressively different on day two, because I think I think they calibrated the displays. I think they were not calibrated precisely the same the first day, and so not with any intent, but just happened to be the way it was. So some of the things he was not directly pointing out that people were observing were more contrasty. But what I found is even when everything was set perfectly, the two images rarely looked the same. The motion image, even when you took the test pattern off, you were using, and you and I saw that as well on the ColorFront demo when they were showing the HDR 10 and 10 plus, the split screens at different nit levels, you know, looked very different. And that's what I find a very interesting challenge that's coming with the HDR, the different sets, the different technologies in the sets, the different mastering protocols. People in Hollywood making movies and making them for home distribution spend a bizarre amount of time making sure that an image is exactly the way they want to see it, this creative intent, the director's intent.
Right.
And they make stuff for the home differently. You know, they make it usually after the theatrical film has been beaten into appropriate shape. They then re-manipulate it because everyone understands that the home viewing environment is radically different from a cinema in many, many ways, even back when it was tube television. All of this effort made to make the picture look exactly right. And every time I go into these environments where you're ABing off the same content and the picture looks different on each set, I am inclined to ask the person who's most familiar with the content, which one of these is the one you intended for the living room? Because they're different. They may be equally interesting. They may not be bad images, but one of them is not the one that everybody worked so hard to make for the
home. Very good point. Very
and
good point.
And the odds today of a high dynamic range image getting into the home and looking anything like what it looked like in the mastering room or the production encoding room seems to be declining with each step in new edition in the technology. It's making a very interesting approach to how do you create a master, hopefully one, not five or six different ones, but then deliver that master into all of these different kinds of TV sets and have each one, and here you start to get now into considerations of metadata in a sense of what is the creative intent. How do I tell the TV what the creative intent was in this master, and then how does the TV act on that data to get as close as that TV can? I'm an OLED. I can't get any brighter than this no matter what I do, but if I adjust my curve to take the brightest I can make and make the contrast to the blackest that I can get look like what the creative intent was, the degree of contrast across the gradient, it won't look just like a QLED screen, but most people don't watch a movie in an A-B comparison, one or another TV set. And if what they get is the best that TV can render from that original creative intent, then maybe the effort shouldn't be so much on matching the displays and matching the colors from one to the other, but rather finding a way to take that single creatively adjusted master and delivering it along with descriptive metadata that lets the TV set extract and reproduce as best it can.
Joey, that was one of the primary points of your presentation, was the single master approach, right?
Yes. Yes. In that particular case, and we actually had demonstrations going on here yesterday all about that. The idea is all this variability that we're talking about with a single master and at least being able to communicate with the set. If we know that the set has a specific capability and or, as an example, we can download an EOTF, an electrical to optical transfer function, the equivalent of gamma or PQ or HLG.
HLG, yeah.
Yes. If we could actually load that into the display from the source, we could actually do things to get the display to be very close to where it is supposed to be to accurately reproduce an image. And yes, there's going to be changes, a matrix transformation to get to exactly what the set can do from where the master was supposed to be. But I'm looking at this situation as an extension of some of the things that already exist. As an example, if you tune into any of the over-the-top channels, whether it's Netflix or Hulu or Amazon, there's a query of your system about the data rate that you can handle. And so mm-hmm. if you can only handle a 720p picture, 720p is what's sent. Well,
right.
I want to take that one step further and have the display tell the source what it's capable of doing and actually have the source configure itself to something that's relatively close to the display and or send instructions to the display saying, make yourself D60 instead of D65. Make yourself Adobe RGB. Make yourself this EOTF instead of that EOTF. And mm-hmm. so what I was advocating is that we are already communicating from the display to the source in at least over-the-top technology, and why not communicate in a much bigger way? Why not tell the source what the display is capable of doing, and instead of just sending down 720p or 1080p or something like that, just send the colorimetry, send the EOTF, send the grayscale information that the set might set itself up for. And I actually believe that if the source were to send instructions to the TV to set itself up for D60 as an example or whatever, it would probably do a better job of getting there than any consumer would do manually anyway. Mm. And so I actually believe that by doing this, we could remove a lot of the variability that we're currently seeing in today's sets.
But Joe, with that thought, don't you think that that's going to cause, oh, God, chaos is a better word. If you want the TV to talk to the source, I'm assuming it's the set-top box or a device there, so that what's coming from Netflix is they're not going to fluctuate what's coming from Netflix, but what the box would do is a different thing. But I'm thinking, from what I'm hearing you say, that two-way street would be nice, but I think it's totally impractical. I mean, to have the set adapt to what the box is doing, I think is a far more economical way of handling the data than trying to do it two-way back and forth. I mean, you're talking a lot of electronics in addition to the information that's already there, like this is who I am, this is what I need. That's kind of like the EDID concept,
well,
right?
And the answer to that is it all comes down to redefining what UHD is. Among the things that I have been advocating for a long time is that UHD needs to be redefined as the communication link between the source and the destination, and it actually has nothing to do with what's at the destination or what's at the source. It has everything to do with being able to communicate between the two. I agree that there are difficulties in doing that now. One of the solutions that is potentially on the table in discussions that we had yesterday, as an example, is that the master, the single master, come down the pike, and so that all the capability of the single master would be at the input to the display or the input to the set-top box or whatever was controlling the display. And so that's the first solution to – I agree with you, Ron, that the communication problems could potentially be horrendous, but I can initially solve that by bringing the single master as close to the display as I possibly can so that the path of communication is short and controllable.
Agreed. That's true. Now, with that said, Scott, thanks, Joe. That's an introduction. They did spend quite a bit of time on ATSC 3.0, which is a two-way communication.
True enough. This is the broadcast standard. We've talked about it on the show as well in times past. The new over-the-air broadcast standard that's going to, sooner than later, I'd say, replace ATSC 1.0, which is what we currently have.
Right.
And that is a two-way street, so to speak. There's data traveling in both directions. So that may be one place where Joe's idea could be implemented as long as we have enough bandwidth to carry all that information. I was just sitting here thinking that another thing that might be required to implement Joe's idea is HDMI 2.1 at a higher bandwidth, which it currently it is specified to be able to support up to 48 megabits per second, which is three times the current maximum bandwidth. And that might be necessary in order to do this. Joe, don't you think?
Yes. And I think to harken back to my statements about HDMI, DisplayPort is still ahead of HDMI.
Good point.
A given. One of the things I hate about HDMI is it seems to be always repairing problems that are already here. It is never looking forward to what might come.
Well, doesn't HDMI 2.1 do that, though?
I don't think anywhere near enough.
Because
I can already present problems that are going to come up that HDMI 2.1 can't handle. And I mean, we aren't even there yet, and I can already tell you where it's going to go out of date.
You're right, Joe.
Well, and when HDMI 2.0 got here, it didn't solve all the problems that were already known before it arrived.
Right.
It solved some of the biggest ones or most conspicuous ones, but
and that's my point. It's always looking backwards. Mm. It's always looking at yesterday.
To clarify, and I agree wholeheartedly, Joe and I have been in agreement with this a long time, that DisplayPort is the way to go, because DisplayPort is nothing but a great big pipe, you know, and you put in it what you want, and you tell it what you want it to do on either end, and it's the chipset on either end that really do it. As HDMI, you have all of these parameters and these restrictions and spaces and code values and things, but you go to DisplayPort, it's just open and it's big and you can do anything you want in it. Well, I think the problem, and everyone would agree, DisplayPort suffers the same problem that Linux does. Nobody owns it. So nobody's pushing it.
Yeah. And nobody makes money on it.
So everybody in the listening audience is going, oh great, you know, I'll go for the DisplayPort thing. You don't own a device that has it and you're not going to get one because they're not in the stores. You know, except your computer display. So if you want to start
right. watching. Right, and I think Panasonic implemented DisplayPort on one or two of its TVs in the past.
They're not selling those in the U.S., though.
No, they're not. They're not selling any TVs in the U.S. at this point. Yeah. You know, the other problem I see with that is HDMI is already so entrenched DisplayPort to sort of come along and supplant it, it's got to overcome just simply the installed base hurdle. It's already been out for so long.
I think Scott, the point I'm trying to make is the people who are trying to push HDMI forward are not looking at what else is out there. HDMI doesn't have to be DisplayPort, but HDMI could learn from DisplayPort. What I'm saying is the example, and I'm using DisplayPort as the example, it's out there. It works. It would do everything we need to do. And the fact that HDMI has an example in front of it and doesn't understand that they need to be looking at that and implementing it and making some equally workable system available, I'm confused. I don't, I, I don't, As I said, the best I can say is they're always looking behind them. They're never looking forward.
Now, you know, THX1138 in the chat room is saying one of the key reasons HDMI trumps DisplayPort for AV is that HDMI will work up to lengths of 10 meters, but DisplayPort is limited to 2 or 3 meters. Is that true in terms of cable length? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, Holly, where's Steve Lampin when you need him?
No, I don't know,
but that to me does not ring true. I think somebody would have screamed that a long time ago.
Actually, with DisplayPort, you can put them in the they're USB boxes and use them as repeaters. I've done that before.
I mean, I can understand how DisplayPort might be cable length limited, because if it's primarily for computer displays, then you're not going to be more than 2 meters from your computer. So that length is not an important consideration there. But for AV equipment, it certainly can be. So that's worthy of some additional study.
Right.
Before we go, and it's way past time to go, Mike Heiss is reminding us that ATSC 3.0 won't really replace 1.0. For many years, they will coexist. So I misspoke earlier. I think that's probably true.
One point there, Scott, is that the ATSC 1.0 was mandatory. 3.0 is not. It's voluntary.
Ah, well, that's one reason why they'll coexist then for a long time.
Exactly.
A lot of stations aren't going to want to upgrade their equipment yet again.
And it's very
expensive.
Or they're
going to have to maintain ATSC 1 as they're doing ATSC 3. That's what I'm worried about. They're going to have to maintain ATSC 1 as they do ATSC 3.
That's so true. Changing the tower elements, not the tower, but the elements, putting in a new exciter in the transmitter, or putting in a parallel feed to the tower, that's expensive. And these days, television stations aren't making a whole heck of a lot of money, so they don't have money to throw around.
I think
at the conference, they didn't make a big deal out of ATSC 3.0 being voluntary.
One last question from iPad 3049. Joe, what's the status of your latest test patterns and so on? I'm pretty sure you're working on UHD, high dynamic range kind of test patterns. What's going on with that?
My distributor has set a deadline that it has to be on the market by the beginning of the fourth quarter. And I think that's the only way it's going to get done.
Well, certainly deadlines do have a way of motivating you. I know this all too well. we've come to well past the end of a fascinating hour. I want to thank you all for being here. And there's so much more we could talk about. I mean, we had 1 hour and plus to talk about what happened over 2 days. So I think we covered a lot of ground here, and I want to thank you all so much for being here. Joe Kane, you can find out much more about his work at videoessentials.com. Joe, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Ron Williams, his website is landmarkcolor.com. Ron, always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Scott.
And Jeff Tully doesn't really have a website, but he's all around anyway. We see him all the time, and so glad to have you here as always, Jeff. Thank you so much.
Always enjoy it.
You can always find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg. And on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be Joel Silver and Mark Henninger, who are almost as we speak finishing up this year's flat panel TV shootout at the CE Week event in New York City. And so we're going to learn about the contestants therein and who won. we actually already know. Go to avsforum.com. Right there on the homepage, you will see the results of this year's flat panel shootout. But next week, we'll be talking about it in quite a bit of detail, so I do hope you will join us for that. Until then, geek out.